All right, good morning. I didn't have a chance to introduce myself. You can see my name here. My name is Eugene Kunin. I run my lab at the National Center for Biotechnology Information. So by definition, I'm a computational biologist and interested in pretty much all aspects of evolution, or from very practical issues of how microbes defend themselves and viruses attack them and so on and so forth, to theoretical aspects of protein evolution and the like. In any case, today we shall discuss one of my areas of interest, which is the tree of life and horizontal gene transfer, and how our thoughts of the tree of life, thanks to the results of microbial comparative evolutionary genomics, change to forest of life, web of life, net of life, mass of life, whatever that is. So, let's get used to this acronym, tree of life. Let me. Basically, I will go through a rather extended introduction here about what people thought and keep thinking about the tree of life. Then we'll present, try to do it in a compact form, some of our observations that I think bear on these ideas, and finish with some more philosophy, hopefully. The tree of life, go. Most of you, I think, through various celebrations in 2009, perhaps, before that, are familiar with this figure. This is the only illustration that Darwin saw fit to put in chapter 4 of his rather famous book. There are no specific organisms mentioned here. This is a conceptual schematic of what was the essence of Darwin's concept of evolution, namely descent, this modification. And Darwin thought that a tree-type graph with some multifurcations, as you can see, is a suitable simile to represent the entire history of life. It didn't take biologists very long to go from, took them only a few years, to go from this conceptual schematic to this much richer representation that comes from the book of Ernst Haeckel, the German successor of, follower of, main German follower of Darwin. Unlike Darwin, Haeckel was a great artist, so he drew this beautiful oak tree, which is populated by all kinds of organisms. And it's all, you know, apes, ape men, all kinds of animals, and non-animal. I don't think plants are here at all, but some lowly creatures, unicellular creatures, are right here, infusoria, amoeba, and then Monera. Monera is actually an now abandoned and then used term for what we know as prokaryotes these days, bacteria and archaea. And in the rest of my discussion, I will try to show how the study of these microbes changes all our ideas about what, or most of our ideas, about what the proper simile for depiction of the history of life might be. 100 years fast forward, Karl Wolff, the small ribosomal RNA sequencing, the great revolution in all of evolutionary biology, perhaps in all of biology, when Wolff and his co-workers came up with what they considered to be the universal marker, universal molecule, the conserved ribosomal RNA that could be used to reproduce, to construct the true tree of life. That the tree of life, as we know now, came up in the form of three major domains: bacteria, archaea, and eukaryote. Of course, eukaryotes are familiar. This is the beautiful tree of Haeckel included these organisms only, pretty much. Somewhere near the root, there was something from here, and that's that. We see now that this is a tiny twig in the diversity of life, and the domain archaea, which is a we shall talk about this more, which is a different kind of eukaryotes that look like bacteria, but genetically, biochemically, biologically are very, very different in many respects. The discovery of this domain was actually the result of Bohr's analysis of 16S RNA molecules. So this was the time of great delight and great expectations that using these molecules, eventually one would be able to reconstruct the complete and true tree of life. All that was nice and good until the advent of genomics. And starting roughly in 1995, we get this obviously exponential growth in the number of sequenced genomes from bacteria and archaea. And this, as we shall see, changed pretty much everything. So the genomic era brought the growing frustration with the discrepancies seen between the topologies of the trees reconstructed for individual genes, and of course the main initial reaction among evolutionary biologists to that was that these discrepancies were introduced above all by the imperfection and errors of phylogenetic tree construction method. By it was all noise, pretty much, and there was a lot of, and there still are, lots of developments in phylogenetics to overcome that noise. At the same time, gradually, there was a growing understanding of the essential role, of the major role of horizontal gene transfer in the evolution of prokaryotic genomes, and with genomics, people started to develop some more innovative approaches to the construction of phylogenetic trees. Instead of limiting oneself to the alignment of one marker gene, like it was the 16S ribosomal RNA, there was quite a bit of effort to try and reconstruct phylogenetic trees from multiple genes, preferably for gene cores that are not particularly prone to horizontal gene transfer, to increase the resolution, supposedly. But also there a lot of methods have been developed to compare different trees, to derive consensus trees, super networks, and so on and so forth, as well as using non-sequence higher order information, so to speak, such as the gene composition of genomes, gene order, distribution of distances between orthologous genes and others, to try and reconstruct trees. The figure that I'm showing here, not very clearly, and don't want to look into the details, anyhow, comes from this rather ambitious work entitled Turns by Per Box Group at Amble, entitled Towards Automatic Reconstruction of a Highly Resolved Tree of Life. So in this case, it was this approach that Burke and Kovarkas applied. Came up with a concatenated alignment of 31 highly conserved genes, all components of the translation machinery, proteins involved in translation, and derived this tree, which was touted as a highly resolved tree of life. Whether or not it's a highly resolved tree of life, and whether or not it really justifies such lofty language as a tree of life, we shall discuss throughout the rest of this talk. At this point, however, I thought I would bring you up to speed with the fundamental phenomenon of a horizontal gene transfer among prokaryotes, among bacteria and archaea. This is an old figure derived by very simplistic methods, but I like to show it because, at least to me, but I think even in general, this was the first time when we, in a way, saw massive horizontal transfer between very different kinds of prokaryotes. So this schematic shows you the genome of a hyperthermophilic bacterium named Aquifex aeolicus. And each digit here, each little cross, represents a gene. And those genes, and the color coding shows the most similar, the taxonomic distribution of the most similar sequences for each individual protein encoded in this genome. And these light blue symbols show you genes that are most similar to other bacterial genes, whereas these yellow symbols show you genes that are most similar to archaeal ones, the different domain of prokaryotes. And you can see here quite a number, about 20% of the genes that appear to show affinities to archaeal homologs. This is a very simple analysis by sequence similarity, but analysis of phylogenetic trees for each individual gene shows about the same. We immediately start seeing that depending on the lifestyle of organisms, the origins of genes may be dramatically different, suggesting that, say, these hyperthermophilic bacteria may have acquired a very significant fraction of their genes from the archaea, and this is still recognizable. And here is a similar comparison of a mesophilic bacterium right here, and you see that the chunk of the quote-unquote archaeal genes is very small here, and this is yet another hyperthermophilic bacterium named Thermotoga in this case, and you see this big chunk of quote-unquote archaeal genes.
So on the previous slide, you had some pluses in between the colored circles.
Oh yeah, that showed genes for which at the time there were no detectable homologs. That's all. Quite similarly, in parallel with that, when we look at two archaeal genomes, a hyperthermophilic one and mesophilic one, we see larger mesophilic one, we see a large admixture of genes that appear, quote unquote, bacterial in the mesophilic genome of an organism that has more opportunity to intermix and interact with bacteria. So what we see inevitably in these comparisons is a great amount of apparent mixing and matching of genes between very different organisms depending on their lifestyles. And I just show you a couple of phylogenetic trees for bacterial and archaeal genes. We don't really care what they are in this part. We don't have the time, essentially, to discuss what they are. But what I want to emphasize here is just this color coding, that we have this blue tree for a variety of bacterial genes with the archaeal branches, with magenta branches interspersed all over the place.
Eugene?
Yes?
Would the sharing of archaeal genes and bacteria be biased by the fact that most of the sequence archaea are hypothermophilic anyway? Or maybe more?
Yes. If anything, most, but now we have a good number of, reasonable number of mesophilic archaea, sacrophilic archaea as well. So this bias is going away. If anything, this leads to an underestimate of that mixing, as we see very clearly when we start looking at mesophilic archaeal genomes, which really seem to suck in lots of bacterial genes. So basically, what I want to emphasize with these trees is that the evolutionary history is gene specific. Different genes generally give trees with different topologies, and the extent of this mixing is quite dramatic, even among highly conserved genes responsible for essential functions. And just an example of yet another such gene involved in a strictly essential function, or highly conserved, and nevertheless showing this mixing of archaeal and bacterial branches. All right. So, some 10 years ago, at the end of the preceding millennium, the growing realization of the extreme extent of horizontal gene transfer in the prokaryotic world led to the idea, expressed primarily for the first time in a very clear, accessible form by Fort Doolittle in several review articles, of, so to speak, uprooting the tree of life. So given that the histories of individual genes, that horizontal gene transfer is rampant, that the histories of individual genes in general are different, there was the idea that the tree-like signal either has been completely lost as the result of the in the course of the evolution of prokaryotes, or actually has been but an illusion to begin with, has never really existed. Accordingly, there are no species in any meaningful sense among prokaryotes, and no other taxa in the sense that we are used to think of taxa for multicellular eukaryotes. And in its extreme form, this new view of the evolution of life, at least the prokaryotic life, but with many implications for eukaryotic life as well, was that whatever consistent tree signal might be observed, this signal is actually created by the distribution of biases in horizontal gene transfer. So, in other words, the tripartite tree of life of the version kind like this, with these recognized horizontal branches which denote the influx of gene from endosymbionts to eukaryotes, maybe with a few horizontal connections that should have been introduced here. According to for Doolittle and other researchers thinking in a similar way, had to be replaced by something of this sort, by a net in which very little, if any, tree-like signal could be recognized. And this is our own representation of about the same idea of the network of prokaryotic genomics, which tries to combine some tree-like segments with this complicated web and emphasizes the role of various kinds of mobile elements in the gene exchange that dominates the prokaryotic world. So I'm deliberately trying to present this rather broadly, and to before going into the details of the tree, or the analysis of the forest of life, so to speak, to show some other aspects of prokaryotic genomics that allow us to perform this extensive analysis of phylogenetic trees for individual genes. And here on this slide, I want to emphasize that this extensive mixing and matching of genes being one aspect of the prokaryotic evolution, there is also a lot of conservation, in the sense that most of the genes, roughly, typically, 70-80% of the genes in any given prokaryotic genome that we can analyze now are rather highly conserved in evolution. Rather highly conserved means specifically they can be included in so-called clusters of autologous genes, COGs as we dub them, which in other words are autologous lineages of evolution. And you do sequence comparisons with sort of transitive closure. You see coherent groups of these genes that share history. They mix and match differently, but each individual gene tends to be fairly well conserved. And actually this the gene universe, so to speak, of the prokaryotes has an interesting sort of fractal structure. At whatever level you look, for instance, at the level of all archaea in bacteria, at the level of archaea only, or at a very shallow level of just a few related bacterial organisms, I avoid calling them species at this point, you pretty much detect, in terms of the population of these clusters of autologous organisms, that is, how many organisms can be included in a misplaced a little these indications on this slide, but never mind. We can detect three distinct parts of this gene universe. The highly conserved core here, which is very small, which includes only about 70 genes, which we find in all or nearly all organisms. Which this part, that is partially conserved, but we denote the shell of the prokaryotic genomes, in which we can include some 6,000 genes. And what we call cloud of relatively rare genes that are found only in a few organisms. So you can observe the structure of these three exponents to approximate this distribution at more or less any level where you analyze the PAM genome of prokaryotes, very shallow or very deep to the very bottom. So once again, this I think shows us the interplay between conservation and diversity in the prokaryotic world. Most of the genes having homologs, but very patchy distribution of these homologs throughout the genomic universe.
Hey, Jim, yes. I have a question about the previous slide.
Yes. I'm sorry. It's this Mac, and I don't immediately. Okay. I can do it. Yes, sir. Yeah.
So so my understanding is that the cloud, the label cloud, should move to the left. And
yes. I'm sorry.
So the question is how sharp, is really the transition between cloud and shell? Because when you plot it on a linear scale, it appears to be sharp when you do those linear fits. But if you plot it on a log scale.
This is semi-log.
Okay, what about if you put a log on the x-axis? My guess is that the transition will become much softer if it will be noticeable at all. So.
As I say, these are best approximated by three distinct exponents. So. Yes, transition will be not as dramatic as it is here, but it still exists.
This counts, for instance, if you have many paralogs in some genome, we will count all of those paralogs within the same hog.
Correct.
And so in some sense, it's well known that at least for paralogs within individual genomes, there is a long paralog tail in the distribution of the.
Yes, that is well known indeed.
So that is the reason, that is the motivation why I'm really curious how this plot would look if you plotted along log coordinates, because you should see some traces of this family size distribution even when you combine all the genomes together.
That is quite possible, and we can simply get it done and see. But as I say. This approximation with three exponents is significantly better that we tested than the approximation with two. We tried that, obviously, and that doesn't work as well. So,
yeah, but I'm also very curious about the cloud one. So there is a very large number of genes or cogs with very few members.
Correct.
Right? So which you have one or two copies, right? So these.
Oh no! Well, not technically the minimum number is two here. I do not put orphans here. That's a separate interesting.
So maybe it's my eyesight. So it's 50. I guess in units of 50. Okay, fine. So yeah. We have a few. So how are we supposed to? So I guess by the time there are 10 of them, I was going to call them orphans. But maybe 10, they're not so orphaned anymore. But it's still a lot of, some sort of very innovative gene. So is this real innovation, or is it the way these cogs are defined so that things that are far away acquire their own denomination?
Well, I think.
So I guess.
To address your question, let me tell you something. Let me tell you a factoid that is not actually shown on these panels. But when we, it's not shown because it's not so convenient to show. But if we place the actual orphans here, yeah. The technical orphans. Those genes for which you do not at this time detect homologs, except maybe in really very closely related strains, you get a point that is disproportionately high, that is not well predicted by this cloud exponent.
I guess before we sort of take exponents too seriously, my question would be how sensitive is that the behavior in the cloud is to the way cogs are defined.
I cannot I cannot immediately, oh, well, in a sense, the answer to your question, I think, is given by comparison of these different panels, which take very different subsets of the data, and yet show you pretty much the same kind of structure. We did not specifically experiment to, you know, to define cogs with different thresholds or something like that. My suspicion is that this is really not going to have any significant effect on anything. But I don't have the detailed information on this. As I say, if we take the technically defined orphans, those for which we really do not see any cogs, that's disproportionate here. There are too many of these, more than predicted. So my suspicion is that actually, in a certain sense, if at some point, and that point may be coming, we have a really representative sample of the prokaryotes on Earth, there are no real orphans. All these genes travel and will technically find, and will fit this cloud. So, in terms of...
Maybe I can actually rephrase the question a little bit. So, there are two issues. One issue is that so the bioinformatic issue I just raised, you know, so some of the things will just accumulate more divergence and will be more difficult to detect. But there's also a biological issue,
yes,
right? Distinction between orthologs and paralogs, right? You want your cogs, of course, so maybe you're going to talk about it.
No, not really. Not.
You're going to talk about it.
Practice.
Think you're asking a question. Right? So we can certainly imagine that you know, there are some environmental niches which are rather uncommon, right? And will require certain specialization, and then there'll be selective forces that will drive the divergence of, you know, some genes into
amplification of some genes.
Yeah.
And that phenomenon exists in prokaryotes, nowhere near the extent it exists, say, in our genomes, but it does exist.
So I guess what I'm trying to say is there a way of identifying distant relatives? Are the guys that appear in the cloud paralogs of something? As an ortholog group, the family is small, but maybe they have very close cousins in large ortholagous groups.
Oh.
Is the cloud enriched for paralogs? That's my question.
Well, not really. And the answer to that is not really, not very significantly enriched. It has to be kept in mind that generally, paralogy in archaea and bacteria is not that extensive. It's a relatively small fraction of the cogs, on the level of 10% or so. Altogether, that have, you know, complex structure of paralogous families. The gene duplication in prokaryotes is actually quite limited, and no, the cloud is not substantially enriched in detectable paralogs of anything. Of course, you know, what is innovation? Well, that's not my subject today, but people are interested, and that's interesting in any case. So what's in innovation? Making protein or RNA coding gene from non-coding sequences? There is very little of that, if any. On the other hand, rapid divergence such that the remaining the memory of the ancestry is obliterated pretty much is the way of innovation. So of course. of course. Rare things are born from here, diverge rapidly, and the memory is erased. That's how this evolution occurs, and when we make any cut, this is what we see.
How much do you think this is influenced by the fact that fully sequenced genomes are show a huge ascertainment bias? Essentially, they're things that are easily culturable from common environments.
Well, on the one, strictly speaking, hard to say. Things that have not been cultured, we don't know. Less strictly speaking, I think we have reasonable representative samples in terms of statistical regularities that we can see. These figures have been done very, very recently. But we have done some similar exercises, say, a couple of years ago with twice fewer genomes or something like that. Nothing much changes. These patterns remain the same. You know, it made sense to speak of a huge ascertainment bias towards pathogens and parasites and so on and so forth. This is not really that important anymore. That bias has diminished quite a bit, and yet, you know, the major regularities that we can see have not changed. So then again, the modern technologies, a few organisms that are not easy to cultivate, that sort of do not fit that paradigm, have been sequenced. If you look at those genomes, you would never guess that it's so difficult to culture them. Which is a challenge, but I think it's also reassuring in terms of our ability to see the stable patterns, let's say.
Also, Eugene, you were talking about points not agreeing, quote, with the prediction.
Yeah.
So are you taking these exponents as a prediction? I mean, is there an underlying theory that gives you the particular three exponents that you're picking up, or is this just a correlation, basically, or a summary of the data?
Let's leave it at the correlation level. We're working on the theory. At the next program, I'll talk about that, not now. Let's keep them as correlation and just... We expect that such theory exists, and so we can be treated as predictions, but I'm not ready to describe it.
That would be interesting.
Yes, it will be interesting, and I have inklings of what it will be, and maybe you will have when we talk about the trees, but not really.
Eugene proceeding.
All right. We'll obviously not finish, but you know, maybe some other time or whatever. That's what is good here. Anyhow. Okay. More to the technical part. Tree and net signals in the evolution of prokaryotes. Actually, we have talked about these issues mostly, but I want to emphasize, actually, something that I think is important. And the important, I have some specific slides to that effect towards the end, but we'll not get there, so why not now? What I would like to emphasize is that if you just think about this in very general terms, I think you will realize that tree thinking actually is not going away from our thinking or from our understanding of evolution. And tree thinking is not going away for a very simple and very fundamental reason. And that is that the gene replication process itself generates, well, we may say a tree, we may say taking into account all kinds of recombinations, directed acyclic graph, but generates some sort of tree-like graph. And therefore, it makes sense to think about trees, to make trees, and to compare trees. Question is, trees for what? And to that effect, we have already realized, we have seen, I showed you a tiny fraction of the observations that indicate that gene histories are different in general. And therefore, tree of life as a totally coherent in a depiction of the history of life is hopeless. Nevertheless, it makes sense to compare, given the fundamentally tree-like nature of evolution, it makes sense to compare trees for individual genes and clusters of genes and see whether or not we can detect some interesting trends. So essentially, there is a whole spectrum of positions among evolutionary biologists these days regarding the tree of life. From the rather irrational, complete acceptance of the tree of life and dismissal of all the other non-tree-like processes as being minor complications, to the complete rejection and the assertion that all the tree, to which I already referred, that all the tree-like patterns that we see are for, let's say, more than a single gene, are a result from biased horizontal gene transfer patterns. All right. So what we did in a series of analysis over the last couple of years. So what we tried to do is to create a sort of a golden set of microbial genomes that would represent the existing diversity, but would be small enough to allow detailed comparative analysis of trees, which we shall see in a few moments. And we created such a set of 100 genomes, 41 archaea and 59 bacteria. It's a good number. It was more or less hand-picked to represent all the known large groups. In this set, we did the clustering cluster analysis to identify. We actually superimposed this set over the existing sets of clusters of autologous genes, COGS, and further developments, and detected here about 7,000 clusters of the size greater than 4. Which could be amenable to phylogenetic analysis, to comparison of tree topologies. These genes represent the core, if we recall those figures that I showed. These genes represent the core, the shell of these genomes, and a little bit of the cloud part. Well, what we do next is, the nature, the usual boring stuff. We make multiple sequence alignments for all of these genes. Coming back to the questions that Boris asked, we need to put away the more diverse paralogs in this case. So we identified what we call index ortologs. That is the members of these cogs that show the greatest sequence conservation, the least divergence, and then we generate maximum likelihood phylogenetic trees for this entire forest of life. What we do next is to construct the distance metrics, now for the trees themselves. It's very familiar, of course, to anyone who has ever been doing any kind of phylogenetic analysis to deal with distance matrices between sequences or genes. Here we go one level up and do a distance matrix between trees. And there are a variety of methods to do so. We did sort of a topological analysis whereby you compute these distances using the fraction of shared bipartitions between the between trees, and if the trees contain a different number of use real species, don't pay attention anyhow, different number of species, prune them to the common set and do this calculation if such a common set exists, and you take into account the bootstrap support for different bipartitions to make the whole thing more reliable. So this is what they do. This is just the structure of that particular forest, the kind of figure that is already familiar to us with this tiny fraction of very highly conserved trees, nearly universal trees, nuts as we call them, and the rest, the shell, and the majority of the cloud, that majority of the clusters that contain a relatively small number of species. You can do a super super network, a super tree of these trees, more or less a consensus tree, and we show and in this tree for the nearly universal cogs, we can see very clearly this distinct separation between archaea and bacteria, but then we can see a mess in the separation of the major groups within each domain of life. Later, I guess I'm running here ahead of myself, we shall see that in some sense this can be used as a standard of vertical evolution, but what we can really see at this point actually is the distinct separation of the three domains, good separation at the tips here in a variety of groups, and a big mess in the middle. So, how nuts do they go? To get some measure of the most dramatic type of horizontal transfer between archaea and bacteria, we do this very simple analysis with just look into those trees and see where we can find you can find an edge which cleanly, perfectly separates archaea and bacteria, and you can see that even in these nearly universal trees, in about half of them, you cannot find such a branch. So apparently, even here, there is considerable horizontal transfer between the domains, and more within the domains, of course. Well, we developed a simple measure, for which I don't show the explicit formula here. It doesn't really matter, but what it does is comparing one single tree to the set of trees, let's say to the entire forest of life, and calculates the score based on the frequency of bipartitions from the given tree occurring in different trees. So the lower the score, the smaller the score, the better is this particular tree as the representation of the trends in the entire flow. And by that measure, we see that all of these nearly universal trees are actually highly consistent. We do the comparison at this point only within this set of nearly universal traits. Then you take... So then you do the same with the set of 102 randomized trees of the same size. You do not see any consistency in that same range, nothing like that. The topologies of these trees, despite the signs of gene exchange even between archaea and bacteria, are very consistent.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
When you identify genes as having been acquired through a horizontal transfer, do you see evidence of positive selection on those genes? So if we, kind of the classic way of thinking about orthologs is they continue in a species and evolve in the presence of other genes with which they've evolved with for a long time. With paralogs, then you get sub-functionalization or near-functionalization
because
the constraint is released.
Yeah.
But you can imagine horizontal gene transfer when it finds itself in with a bunch of genes that it hasn't seen before, that there's a great opportunity for
Yes. That's right. One would expect, one would actually expect transient acceleration of evolution and realization of rapid selection. Perhaps some positive selection. A note to this is that, of course, you should be able to detect this only in recently transferred genes. When we talk about something like, ancient transfer between archaea and bacteria, anything like that, that's long gone. They settled into regular regimes of evolution. In recently transferred genes, anecdotally, there are stories of evolutionary acceleration and some positive selection. Systematically, I think that remains to be done, actually. It's not so easy. It's not so easy to do. These effects do not really jump on you in these comparisons. In most cases, we actually trying to detect that acceleration of evolution on large scale without very much success. It's relatively subtle, although it's in some animal species. Yes. Oh, I can watch it.
You
actually don't need it here. It's just for the recording. Yeah. So, of course, you can play all kinds of games with those trees as vertices in a graph, and here I represent a sort of a network and take the cutoff by similarity to draw edges or by similarity rather than by distance, but that's just the 1 minus distance, basically. We confirmed very clearly that among these knots, at say 50% of similarity, 50% of identical bipartitions, you get a completely connected component. So the topologies are indeed quite similar. So when we try to see whether there is, we have seen that they are highly consistent, these nearly universal traits. Now we try to see, is there in that cloud, but they are distributed anyhow in terms of their topology somehow. So is there a distinct structure? Are there distinct clusters among these among these nearly universal traits? Answer to the and we used classic multi-dimensional scaling to address this question and gap function to determine the existence of distinct clusters, and the clear answer here is no. There is a single centroid to this cluster. There no, to this cloud of nearly universal trees. No distinct structure within it. So basically, what it seems like is that the trees in that group of nearly universal genes. Essentially, that's the core of the prokaryotic gene universe that I showed you on those distribution slides. The topologies of these trees are highly consistent. They seem to follow a single common evolutionary pattern. Deviations from that pattern cannot be shown to be significantly non-random. They appear to be random. In other words, the relationship between these nearly universal genes looks like a tree, or like it carries a tree-like signal. That's the best we can conclude, that there is indeed a signal of vertical evolution between these trees. Perhaps as a footnote here, I need to note something. Usually, in all kinds of comparisons, that are attempts on inference of horizontal gene transfer, people use some kind of standard of vertical evolution. For instance, the ribosomal RNA tree, the tree of concatenated ribosomal proteins, something like that. Here, we actually avoided quite deliberately doing so, and just did the topological comparison. But essentially, this topological comparison show that same thing. The tree-like signal exists in this group. And with that,
So, conversely, looking at these nearly conserved set of genes, and the answer might be sort of anecdotal, is there any evidence of horizontal transfer there? You know, deduced from some other signal, I don't know, GC content or...
No. I showed you actually this pie chart to give you the feeling for that, for mixing of archaea and bacteria, and then you analyze individually. Yes, absolutely. There are GC content is not such a great indication of horizontal gene transfer, again because this only detects very, very recent transfers. But again, by comparing the topologies of individual trees, these are clearly detectable. Even among, say, ribosomal proteins that are considered to be so non-transferable, part of the same complex, and so on and so forth, yes, there is less than, say, among metabolic enzymes, but they're clearly detectable. The point is that they're more or less randomly scattered there, with some exceptions again, but statistically randomly scattered. So, now going to the entire forest of life. We had a tall tree of life, and we have four. We have nuts, and we have four. Forest of life. And what we do here is do another network in which we compare these group of 102 nearly universal trees to the rest of the forest of life. And what we see here is a fairly good thing, a fairly reassuring thing, that the topologies of these trees are in general highly similar to the topologies of many trees in the entire forest. The overall distance, or overall similarity, the mean similarity between these nearly universal trees, and the rest of the forest of life is about 0.5, which is incomparably greater than what you see for the randomized trees of the same size. And quite a substantial part of the forest of life is very similar in topological terms to the trees in this nearly universal group. Interesting question. Somehow I cannot move here. I really don't know what happened here. That's way too far. Now we can. I guess it's a big slide and it doesn't work very properly on the Mac. So let me step here. I think it's the next one. Maybe I had something in between, but probably not. So that's just as well, I should say. So then we can make these conclusions about the. Oh. Shall I attempt to go back?
No, wait. Just
wait. That's right. It does do anything like that on my computer. Don't know what is going on. In any case, we just as well can conclude that the trees in the entire forest are much more diverse in topological terms, and if this does come up again, we shall see just how, than those nearly universal trees. Nevertheless, the positive message is that there are quite many of them are topologically very similar to the nearly universal trees, and the thing is not coming up again. And so it seems like these nearly universal trees can be taken to, at least tentatively, to represent a central trend in the entire forest. Okay, I don't know why it growls like this. In any case, my main conclusion is that it makes sense to speak of the existence of the central trend, and the nearly universal trees might represent that central trend. There is a slide there that I want to show.
Could you just go to the slide sorter? I'm not a Mac person, so I cannot help you.
Just press Escape.
And then you go to the slide sorter and pick the slide you want.
May I do so? I don't think so. It's thinking and not reacting. So let me tell you. Good work. It's quite difficult. Let me tell you something. Okay. We can just do this after all.
Okay, blackboard.
So we can, when we do this multidimensional scaling analysis for the entire forest of life, like I showed you for the nearly universal guys, what we see here is quite different. In the sense that
it came up.
Okay. Yes. Okay. I was so hopeful that finally I can give a black box. Anyhow, what we see here is the existence of distinct cluster structure here. It's somewhat difficult detect the statistically best number of clusters here, but we still use the Tipshirani gap function to show that there are at least 7 of those. On those clusters that differ in different ways. We don't really have the time to discuss it in detail in terms of what organisms are included or what are the functions of the genes involved and so on and so forth. And what is, I think, rather important is that the distance from the cluster of these nearly universal trees to each of these clusters in the fall is very close, just about the same, not just about the same, but approximately these nearly universal trees are equidistant from the rest of the forest.
Is there any functional signatures in each of those colored? I mean, just look up functions. Would you be able to make some sense out of it, or?
Yes. The short answer is yes. Of course, nothing is absolute here, but yes. We have published that actually. All right, we have made these conclusions already. Now, how do I go back?
There is a button.
Yes.
There is, just go to the lower left as opposed to upper right.
Okay, we can do this.
Button, say it's one. That's the one.
But it's the same. I'm terribly sorry. This is literally the first time I'm doing any presentation on the Mac.
And probably the left.
Oh, you never know.
Once you try it, you never go back.
No, I'm going back. don't try to talk me to that. All right. In any case, some finer aspects of this structure of the forest. If you recall the sort of a consensus tree that I showed you on one of the earlier slides, the super tree of the knobs, I mentioned that there was a clear split between the two domains, good separation at the teeth, and mass in the middle. And therefore, what we thought was a sensible thing, in a sense, important thing to do, was to look at the inconsistency in that between the trees as a function of depth in the super tree, to which end we converted this super tree into an ultrametric tree with the scale from 0 to 1 and calculated level of inconsistency down to a particular level. What we see here is quite striking, I believe, because what we see is something like a phase transition at a particular depth that roughly corresponds to the radiation of the main archaeal and bacterial group. So, at this point, we sort of got fanciful and started thinking, what was going on here? And in terms of what was going on here, it's very clear that in the least, what is going on is something that I will denote compressed cladogenesis. That is, in this radiation of the main phyla, the evolution was very fast, the very short internal branches. At most, we thought, what would be happening here was, so to speak, a biological Big Bang, an exchange so extensive that all tree signal would be obliterated in principle and completely impossible to reproduce. So was the phylogenetic signal completely destroyed by a Big Bang type of event? So we tried to do simulations of the both types of evolution by doing a complete scrambling of the trees at a certain level, and then allowing controlled horizontal gene transfer, that is swapping of the branches, at certain rates. What comes out of it is completely contrary to my expectations, and I may say hopes. Because my hopes were that we would be able to conclude that the deepest phase of the evolution of archaea and bacteria represented a veritable Big Bang where we cannot detect any tree signal period. This does not seem to be so, because the best fit to the observed inconsistency curve, this dependence of inconsistency on depth in the phylogenetic tree, was seen where we did not have a Big Bang event, this complete scrambling event. That is, we could only place it below the divergence of the major archaeal and bacterial group, which is effectively our event horizon. So in this model, this means no Big Bang, but rather a model of compressed cladogenesis is actually a relatively small number of swaps, horizontal gene transfers. It's just shows you whether we can reproduce this level of inconsistency drop, and we only reproduce it if we place the Big Bang at a depth where it becomes meaningless, where we cannot really see that scrambling anymore, because this is below the divergence of the archaeal and bacterial phyla. This transition is much more dramatic. On the other hand, we see that this transition is much more dramatic in the entire fall than it is in the nearly universal trees. So basically what we can conclude from all of this analysis is that, strange as that might be, given the appearance of the trees, given the amount of horizontal transfer, and so on and so forth, strange as that might be, we actually observe something like a tree signal throughout the evolution of the prokaryotic world. It has to, compressed cladogenesis is certainly there and quite pronounced, and therefore it may be effectively hopeless to try and produce a definitive branching order for the major bacterial and archaeal phyla. However, it seems like that in principle that coherent signal of vertical evolution was there throughout the history of the prokaryotic world, which is the same as the history of life.
How much do you think this is influenced by your alignment and tree building methods? Because they can vary greatly in how accurate they are when you use simulated data. I wondered what do you use for your alignment and tree building?
Well, we use fairly standard methodologies. You know, we to get purely technical on this, we use muscle foil alignment, remove the bad stuff with G blocks, and then do maximum likelihood trees by the Braxamel, as I said, we we do this book split distance method for comparison of the trees. So it's all pretty much only the well-supported parts of the trees that contribute. If we come to that, which is not very likely, in the remaining part of my talk. We have the introductions. I think I have another 10 minutes or so. Where is the boss? The boss is not here anyhow. Here. Oh, sorry. In any case, you see that actually the reliability of the trees does not depend very much here on the tree size, which will become an issue later on. So.
I saw a talk by Tandy Warner last week on their satay method, and some improvements have done to that. And it seemed like when you try to align large numbers of sequences, the fact that there's lots of things in there that are, whilst still homologous, quite different, that aligning them introduces a lot of artifacts. And so the newer methods only align the things that can really be alignable, create trees from those, but there'll be things in common between groups, and then they create super trees. And they say on simulated data, they're so much more accurate than if you just try to align everything and build a tree from that.
Yeah, I'm familiar with Tandy's work, of course. She's visiting my group incidentally now, so I'm familiar with her work. This is not what we did here, but note one thing, that Tandy was actually working with thousands and thousands of sequences. Sure. And these artifacts emerge at that level. So quite deliberately, we used here, as I said, a hand-picked sample where the maximum number of aligned sequences, and that's among very highly conserved proteins, is 100. And if something doesn't pass the G blocks, we just throw it away. If there are a few reliable positions, in practice that happens very rarely. There are very few of bad alignments that are really bad. So all the definitely the alignment. Well, the alignments are fairly good here. The tree reconstruction is never perfect. We know that perfectly well. However, what I would like to suggest here is that we are actually playing on the conservative side. Despite all these known problems, we do detect this signal. My suspicion is that whatever improvement we apply, and we very well may, this will only increase it. All right. So the last part that I will be realistically able to present here goes to a somewhat different methodology. To an attempt to chart the prokaryotic space-time, so to speak, the evolving prokaryotic universe in terms of distinguishing between tree and net-like signals. For that purpose, we used the so-called quartet methodology, which has been put to different users in phylogenetic analysis. To my knowledge, not to this particular use so far. So basically, a quartet is simply a group or a set of four species. Quite obviously, in an unrooted tree, it can have three distinct topologies. There are, of course, altogether lots of these topologies, about 12 million of these topologies in the set of 100 species. And then what we do is to map these quartets on the individual trees in the forest of life, and compare the support for each of the three topologies throughout the forest. And what we can do here is to calculate the distance between each of these, each of the analyzed species in terms of this quartet topology support. Very simply put, if a pair of species is always together, that is one particular topology in this quartet occurs 100% of the time, the distance is zero, and if they, the three topologies are equally frequent, the distance is one. So we have been talking about the distance matrices between trees. Now we go back to the distance matrices between species or organisms produced, however, on the basis of tree topologies. In other words, what we are trying to do is to evaluate the contribution of the tree-like and non-tree-like components of evolution in the relationship between these different organisms. And this is how we present these results. This is the distance matrix between trees, where we put these species in the order they occur in the in that super tree of the nearly universal trees that I showed you. So this is this kind of heat map from the knots, and the more green you see here, the more close are the related species, and the more red you see, the more distant they are. You see in this matrix a very clear diagonal signal of closeness between species, and you see a very clean separation between archaea here and bacteria here. However, with some dirt, so to speak, but relatively little, seen here, pointing to horizontal transfer between bacteria and archaea, and much more mess happening within each of the domains. When you look at the same kind of matrix for the rest of the fall, that's already very different. You still see this diagonal signal of coherent groups of organisms, but you also see much more mixing here, even between archaea and bacteria, and much more so within the archaeal and bacterial domains. Now, if you start now slicing and dicing the forest of life in different ways, you see very clearly that for large trees, with a large number of species, essentially these are the knots. You see this clean separation, that is strong vertical signal, and then you see the declining gradient of this vertical signal down to here, and in the smallest trees, you basically see mostly the web-like signal. Actually, we have come to that part that I mentioned before. Somehow we managed. One of the ideas here was simple. Ideas here was that the trees for the small number of species were simply bad. Well, this is not the case. The level of bootstrap support generally does not depend on the tree size. Again, to make sense of these trends, you can also classify the trees by function of the corresponding genes. And here, well, they're designated by letters, but I will just mention a few. For instance, here, for genes involved in translation, you see the vertical signal about as good as it ever gets, which of course correlates with the size of the trees, but much less than perfectly. And for instance, if you look this at this panel that corresponds to energy metabolism, or to this panel that corresponds to signal transduction, you see here a strong dominance of the web-like signal. Mostly the evolution of these genes is governed by horizontal non-tree-like processes. And I suppose the last thing that I can realistically tell you, I'll rush through the next few slides, but the last thing that I can really tell you is the attempt to quantitate the amount of the signal, of the tree-like signal and the net-like signal in this set of nuts and in the entire flow. To do so, we just rescaled the distances between species on the scale of 0 to 1, where 0 vertical signal corresponds to the random expectation and to the randomly expected distance between species the 0.1 corresponds to the distance between species in that super tree, which we take with all caveats as the standard of vertical tree-like evolution. And we see very contrasting results for the nearly universal trees and for the entire forest of life, with speaking quite roughly here, in the grove of nuts, about two-thirds of evolution being tree-like, and in the entire forest of life, about two-thirds of evolution being net-like or web-like. And this is interesting, actually. This is quite non-random in the sense that this tree-net-like tree-net trend score, as we call it, is consistently significantly greater among archaea than it is among bacteria. Apparently, this is more tree-like evolution in the archaea. And there is, by the way, very strong correlation between the tree-net score among the nuts and in the entire forest, indicating, importantly, I think, that this relationship between tree-like and nut-like evolution is a is lineage-specific, is a characteristic of distinct groups of archaea and bacteria. And we can see also the functional breakdown, rather similar to those that I showed you previously. And I think this is where I pretty much have to stop. There are more stuff, but we don't have the realistic opportunity to discuss it. Basically, what we have to conclude that there is this vertical signal with a bit of a paradox in the characterizing the evolution of the prokaryotic genes and genomes. Because on the whole, very much unlike the nearly universal trees that are really tree-like, on the whole, the evolution in the entire genomic universe of prokaryotes is dominated by web-like processes, by exchange processes. But the single strongest trend is nevertheless the tree-like signal that can be approximated by the evolution of these nearly universal trees. This is where I more or less stop, but I want to go to my acknowledgement slide just to show you the faces of the people. There was more simulation to address the possibility that the tree-like signal is a consequence of biased horizontal transfer, but that I don't have a chance to explain, unfortunately. Well, I guess that's a fitting conclusion, actually. That's, I think, how that is, coming back to the very beginning. And here are the people. Very few of those who directly participated, Barry Pulichbo, a postdoc in my group, and Yuri Wolf, a senior scientist in my group, and several people, Bill Martin, Fox Doolittle, Peter Gogarten, Marina Melle, were very instrumental in discussing all this stuff. Thank you very much.
So one of the kind of striking patterns is that as your size of the category gets smaller, it gets more and more prone to be net-like, right? If I understood it correctly.
Yes.
So do you have? Can you share any thoughts of why it might be the case? Is there a reason a little bit similar to what Boris proposed at some point, that if you're if it's something which is specialized to some very narrow niche? And a group of organisms evolved it for a niche, then you know they're more than happy to share this function with other organisms, which, well, maybe they are not happy, but the small niche tends to be shared by horizontal transfer more than by vertical transfer.
Oh, I think that goes fairly close to my preferred explanation. Not entirely sure I understand what you mean by small. By small, you mean like narrow niche.
Yeah, narrow niche in ecological sense.
Right. So I think that's reasonable. My general take on this is roughly simply this: the size of an orthologous gene set, or in other words, the frequency of a gene in that genomic universe, is more or less inversely proportional to the thickness effect of the knockout of the gene, if you want to say it in vernacular terms, to the importance of this gene. And on average, it's easier to put a less important gene into a new environment. It takes less adjustment, especially if the environment is significantly new. So statistically, in general, the trend works. There has been a very interesting publication recently that showed the decline of complementation of orthologous genes from different bacteria experimentally with the increasing increasing sequence divergence. It really does seem to exist. It's quite anecdotal, but pretty striking. It really does seem to exist. Therefore, I think that these rare genes, simply put, are more free to evolve in different ways.
So when you compare these two modes, the natural gene transfer, now as you have this sort of nearly universal tree, can you say something how the transfer pattern relates to that tree? So is it orthogonal, or is it in some sense maybe more frequent along tree-like related species, or are they really
Yes. It's not random. It's more common among the tree-like related organisms, very much along the lines that we just discussed with Sergei, that in a way, come to think of it, it seems like the pattern of evolution is relatively trivial. If you are in the sense that when you are similar, it's relatively easy to transfer a gene into a similar intracellular environment, with an important deviation with respect to the lifestyles. Let's say, as I showed in the beginning, there is a lot of gene exchange between hyperthermophiles of different kind. So these are the second momenta, so to speak, of this process. But the gradient from more tree-like related organisms to the less tree-like related does seem to exist. And actually, in those simulations that I just didn't have a chance to discuss, they address this very question, show that the pattern is compatible with that. Please.
Well, so you did this coordinate analysis to define you know, some sort of a distance matrix, which was more or less banded. So
which was more or less
banded.
Oh yes.
More or less diagonal. Uh-huh. So, but you can imagine defining a distance based on various other things. For example, right, once you sort of identify that some cogs are very sporadic, right, seem to hop, right, to have very sporadic phyletic distribution, you can just use this phyletic distribution of cogs to define distance between your, you know, leaves on the tree, right?
Mm.
Between any two species, you know, how much they share of those sporadically distributed cogs.
You could.
And would that be very different from what you derive from this quartet analysis?
Oh.
You see, oh,
it's a nice point. And the key word here is would. We did not do it exactly that way. Nevertheless, you ask it very different. But I think the substance of the question goes very close to what Michael asked.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. So my strongest suspicion is that no, that's, well, I think it follows from the self-similarity of these distributions that I showed you in the close to the beginning, that the results of this analysis is not going to be particularly difficult, or particularly different from the result obtained in the quartet. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I think so.
Right. So in a sense, we have that.
Okay.